This is an ABC podcast.
An invented religion is a religion where the founders don't attempt to link the new teachings to a tradition, to argue that they have received revelation from a supernatural source, or any of the other legitimation strategies that have traditionally been used to make religions appear authoritative. An invented religion announces its own invention.
Hi, I'm Rowan Salmond, joining you for Soul Search with a feature about religion and popular culture. Do people really take things from fiction and incorporate them into their actual spiritual lives? Turns out, yeah, they kind of do. Let's explore the fascinating world of invented religions and fictional faiths. From Jediism to chaos magic to the Church of All Worlds, fiction is fertile ground for religious ideas. Carol Cusack is Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Sydney and author of the book Invented Religions, Imagination, Fiction and Faith.
When I wrote the book in 2009, it was published in 2010, so that's some time ago, I did substantial extended treatments of Discordianism, which was founded in 1957, the Church of All Worlds, which was founded in 1962, and the Church of the Subgenius, which was founded in 1979. And then I grouped together what I called third millennium invented religions, and that was Jediism, Matrixism, you know, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. And of course, as well as those three, there's Dudism, which was based on the Coen brothers film, The Big Lebowski. It was founded by an American journalist called Oliver Benjamin, who is known as the Dudley Lama. He lives now in Chiang Mai in Thailand and runs the religion from there. So these sorts of things come in and out of popularity. There are other religions that resemble invented religions that maybe aren't based on pop culture texts. I would think about, say, Copimism, which was founded by Isaac Yersin in Sweden, which is a church dedicated to the free distribution of information, file sharing, the idea that there are no secrets and no restrictions. Now, this is very interesting because a lot of people would say, well, that doesn't sound very religious. But of course, the Discordians had a thing that they called copyleft, which was spelled with a K. And it was the idea that every piece of information that you ever found, you passed on to as many people as possible, that you were not, the idea that there were secrets or there was restrictions was something that they found appalling. And they also very strongly connected to anarchist-style politics, which a lot of these groups are. Church of the Subgenius is as well.
In the past, it's been a joke to put down Jedi as your religion in the census, but there are examples of people who practice Star Wars-inspired faiths quite seriously. In 2009, The Guardian reported that the founder of the International Church of Jediism was ejected from a supermarket after he refused to lower his Jedi hood. He claimed his religion dictated that the hood should be worn in public places. You know, people have been taking direct religious inspiration from the media they consume for a long time, and like more mainstream religions, it inspires ethical and political action. Some, like the supermarket manager, I'm sure, would argue that if a religion can simply be invented, this kind of religious protest shouldn't be afforded the same protection or respect as a faith with more history. But to some extent, aren't all religions invented?
The question of whether all religions are invented or not is actually extremely important from an academic point of view, but it's one that's very difficult to go into with non-religious studies scholars generally. One of the issues is that religious studies is a secular academic discipline. It's not like theology, which is a conversation within a faith community. And so when you study religion from a social scientific, historical, archaeological, psychological perspective in a religious studies department, the assumption is that you are studying human cultural products anyway. And so the question of metaphysical origins or divine truth, these questions are not considered proper if you are a religious studies academic. And I'm perfectly content to state that I believe all religions that have ever existed are human cultural products, which means that they were ultimately originated, invented, devised, initiated by human beings. But of course, that is a position which can be offensive to people of faith. And yes, the reason I use the term invented religions to refer explicitly to religions that did not scruple to disguise their invented status is because that is one way of separating them from the other group of religions, which generally don't admit that they're invented. Most invented religions kind of riff off modern paganism, which is sort of the ancestor of all of the family of religions that I'm primarily interested in. Like, I know that there are many new religions across the world that derive from Christianity. By and large, I don't work on them at all. I'm interested in the religions that work off indigenous traditions, revived pagan traditions, say from the ancient world or the medieval world. And so invented religions most definitely sit in that basket. Some of them much more definitely fit it. So a church like the Church of All Worlds is basically a modern pagan religion, even though it is invented and it has a fictional scripture underlying it, whereas some of the other religions, like perhaps Jediism, don't fit the pagan template quite so well, and they look a little bit more like Eastern traditions, particularly Taoism and other ideas from China, because the force has kind of a resemblance, I suppose, to Qi, ideas about energy.
Since Disney has acquired that franchise and are creating new works within that universe, there is the risk that they might define Jediism or the Jedi Order in a way that doesn't align with how it's being practiced by
real world people.
How do practitioners of that sort of invented religion square that?
Jedis don't think that the Star Wars products are like amazingly authoritative. They'll normally say that they're like guiding stories or myths, and that what comes out of the Jedi Order from the Star Wars universe is an idea around honourable masculinity and ethics and that kind of thing. Jediism is not heavily belief invested. It would be a complete mistake for anyone listening to this conversation between us to imagine that people who are members of religions based on novels or films actually believe in those novels and films, in the sense of thinking, like generally believing Christians do, that there literally is a God and a heaven and a Jesus who historically existed and that all of these things are real. They don't believe in that way. And so I would say that is probably the greatest evidence for the way in which modern people construct themselves and their world, which is that we are very happy to play with ideas that are provisional. We don't necessarily commit particularly strongly.
One of the invented religions Carol has spent a lot of time studying is the Church of All Worlds, based on the novel Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert A. Heinlein.
The Church of All Worlds was founded on the 7th of April in 1962 by two American college students, Richard Lance Christie and Tim Zell. They were both studying psychology. They were very interested in alternative politics, alternative lifeways. They were passionate fans of science fiction. And over their spring break, they'd read the novel Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert A. Heinlein, which had been published a year earlier in 1961.
If you haven't read Stranger in a Strange Land, here it is in a nutshell. You're about to hear a lot of spoilers, but to be fair, you've had since 1961 to read it, so here we go. A human orphan named Valentine Michael Smith is raised on Mars, and after he grows up, he's brought back to America, where he encounters American religion. Mike decides to found his own faith, called the Church of All Worlds, which includes doctrines similar to anarchist politics and free love. He's eventually martyred, but transforms the world through his teaching.
Anyway, what happened with the Church of All Worlds was after it was formed, for the first maybe 4-5 years, it mostly was based on Stranger in a Strange Land, and the rituals that were devised were based on the book, and the names for different groups organising in what's called nests and nine circles and so on. And then in 1967, I think, Tim Zell met Frederick McLaren Adams, who was a pioneering pagan in America. And he's best known now probably for founding a group called Feraferia. But before that, he'd led a group called, I think, the Fellowship of the Hesperides. And when Zell met him, they began talking about the modern pagan template, which comes from Gerald Gardner and Wicca, which he founded in the late 40s and early 50s. And it has the 8 major Sabbats, the festivals throughout the Wheel of the Year, and the Esbats, which are the full moon festivals for each lunar month of the year. And after that, Church of All Worlds began to refer to itself as a pagan religion and to absorb ideas from eclectic Wicca, I suppose would be the best way to describe it. And then in the early 70s, Zell had a vision of the earth as goddess, and that was kind of the last piece of their theology that needed to kind of lock into place. And so Church of All Worlds is a kind of eco-pagan religion from that point on.
The Church of All Worlds has nearly disbanded a few different times. And so is there a sense where these invented religions, their observance is tied to the popularity of the thing that they're based on? Or do they have a life outside of the actual fiction?
Oh, yes. Inventive religions, okay, that is an interesting question. What about the popularity of the fiction or the pop culture phenomenon that they are linked to? I suspect Heinlein is not as famous now as he was in the 1960s or the 1970s, which is okay. Things pass out of currency in popular cultural expectations. The Church of All Worlds continues, and it's a long-standing, long-running religion. I was born in 1962. The Church of All Worlds is 60 this year, the same as I am, and it is probably the most established of the invented religions in terms of longevity, size of numbers, number of countries that it appears in, some obviously more so and some less. They've always been majority members in America, but they've always had nests in Australia and Britain and Germany and the Netherlands and a few other countries here and there. And so it has, I think, legs to survive further into the future.
It's interesting to me about how, in particular, these are almost by definition minority faiths, and how you find a sense of community in these invented religions. Maybe does the internet have something to do with that?
There's a whole lot of things that have contributed to the possible formation of these sorts of religions. The internet obviously is very important, but the big ones, Discordians and Church of All Worlds, Church of Subgenius, were all formed before the internet was a thing. Mm. So the internet is important, but it's not a necessary condition, if you use that in the technical philosophical sense, mm-hmm. that it's needful to be there. What is really needed is a community of fans. And this is one of the places where you can see that there's a kind of continuum. And if you look at fandoms, there are at the most mild end of the spectrum just people who like the pop culture thing. In the middle, there are the fans who organise their lives around the pop culture thing. So they go to conventions, they cosplay. If they're Star Trek fans, they learn Klingon. If they're Tolkien fans, they learn Elvish. And that group in the middle, which we might call intense fans or extreme fans, where the interaction with the pop culture phenomenon is by and large a defining characteristic of their life, they're the groups from which splinter off groups that make religions out of the particular phenomenon.
Yeah, when it comes to things like Lord of the Rings and the Forgotten Realms setting in Dungeons and Dragons, and you have these pantheons, and there's a lot of interest and study in, you know, academic and non-academic situations, and lots of, I guess you might call, theology written about these fictional gods. It really does blur the line between fandom and, I don't know, piety, maybe? What do you think about that?
I think there are overlaps, but the phenomenon that you're discussing there is distinct. There's been a lot written about the theology of Middle Earth as far as Tolkien developed it.
You mean his Christianity as it applies to it, or as a separate thing?
No. Tolkien's text is really interesting. And, you know, when I was young, it was one of those things. I read The Lord of the Rings every Christmas holiday from 13 to 20. And so I was very immersed in it. And I have met many students over the years who are also very immersed in it. Because he had this idea that to create a fictional world, he called it sub-creation or secondary creation, and he thought it was like a pale reflection of the creation that God had actually done in creating the real world, and that there was a sense in which somebody who was an author or an artist who created a secondary world was engaged in the same type of activity as God and could only do it because it was kind of God-given gift. And he wrote a story called Leaf by Niggle. I don't know if you know it. It's about a guy called Niggle who wants to paint a marvellous tree, and in the end he paints the marvellous tree so marvellously that it comes to life. Mm. It is a real tree. So when I'm talking about people talking about the theology of Lord of the Rings, if you read it one way, it is in fact a Christian text. That's not difficult. But it's also amazingly polysemous, really. You can read it as an ecological text. You can read it as a pagan text with the elves as a kind of god group within the book. So when I say people talk about religion within pop culture sources, it's a kind of literary criticism, really. And I've always been interested in the people who want to make it happen in the real world, and that's quite different.
Carol Cusack, Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Sydney. I'm Rowan Salmond, with you for Soul Search on RN and the ABC Listen app. Recently, I spoke to Dr. Joseph Laycock, who's an expert on the game Dungeons & Dragons and all the anxieties some conservative Christians had about it and how it would affect the faith of players. It made me wonder if fictional religions really do cross into the real world. He gave me an answer I wasn't expecting. Actually, something that I've wondered, have you ever come across somebody who has adopted the characters from, say, Forgotten Realms as a way to structure their own worship, that kind of thing?
That's a really interesting question. I think that has definitely happened, and it can happen in a number of ways. In sort of contemporary magical communities, there is what's called chaos magic. And chaos magic is the idea that, you know, you can kind of make spells out of whatever is sort of handy or personally significant to you. It doesn't have to be from part of ancient tradition or an ancient source. So chaos magicians will use comic book characters and TV shows and things like this. So it would not surprise me at all if one of them had sort of used something like Forgotten Realms or Dungeons and Dragons as a basis for doing some type of spell to maybe give them confidence, right? Make them feel more savvy in a particular social situation or something like that. I'm sure someone has experimented with something like that.
If you missed my full interview with Joseph, have a look on the ABC Listen app and there'll be a link on the Soul Search website. I confess, I had never heard of chaos magic before, so I was a little surprised. Thankfully, Carol Cusack is just the right person to ask. What is chaos magic? And how does it work with fictional gods?
Well, it's an interesting subject to bring into conversation with this topic because it's actually quite different, but it reflects certain, I suppose, societal changes which are similar or in parallel. The sorts of religions I was talking about begin with Discordianism in 1957. And it's the only one that's in the 50s. The rest are all post the 1960s. And what we see in the middle 20th century is a very considerable retreat of institutional Christianity as a determinant of what people can believe, can't believe, how they'll organize their lives, etc. So chaos magic is a kind of magic that grows out of a similar kind of liberalizing or opening up of what used to be called, well, it still is, ceremonial magic, which belonged to some of the so-called occult orders, groups like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and the Ordo Templi Orientis, which Aleister Crowley, who died in 1949, I think, was associated with. So anyway, the key figure in the middle is a man called Austin Osman Spare, who was an artist and actually an official war artist, World War I, but he was also an occultist, and he came to despise learned magic of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn kind, and he developed a highly personal kind of, I suppose, what is broadly accurate to describe as sex magic. And this was highly original, and he wrote a whole lot of highly original books about it. He developed a personal mythology, the Zoskea mythology, and ideas around sexual fusion and the androgyne and a whole lot of things. And it could have all just disappeared. Like, people might never have known about it, except that in his old age, when he was quite frail, he was befriended by Kenneth Grant, another occultist who ran an order called the Typhonian Order, with his wife Steffi, who was also a significant party to these sorts of things. And Spare, therefore, was kind of rescued from obscurity. And so what happens when the chaos magicians come along, and again, it's difficult because there's always groups, and the people who are identified as leaders or who get known as names are not the only people. But at the beginning, the important people are Peter Carroll, who wrote The Liber Null and a book called Psychonaut, and Ray Sherwin, who wrote a book called The Book of Results. And somewhere around about 1976, they started collaborating on this project. And it kind of radically deconstructed the ceremonial magic world and concentrated on results, as Sherwin's title, The Book of Results, suggests. And so another important chaos magician, Phil Hine's book Oven Ready Chaos, basically says you can do it with anything. It's got to work. So it's about your will and the way that you direct your mind in terms of the practice. But he is probably the person who mostly opened it up to a lot of people who realised that you could invoke really figures who were fictional, figures who were invented within a chaos paradigm, and it didn't matter at all.
So instead of a pantheon that you might have found in pre-Christian societies like the Greek or Egyptian pantheon, people might use fictional characters or gods from their favourite work or movie. Is that what happens?
Yeah, totally. That could happen and it wouldn't be a problem.
Just to come back to the faiths within the fiction itself. So, for example, the pantheon of gods in the Forgotten Realms or even the Jedi Order. These are very popular works, widely distributed. A lot of people have engaged with them on some level. How do these depictions of fictional faiths reflect our attitudes towards religion in the real world, do you think?
That's a complicated question. I'm not sure that the religions as depicted in books like The Lord of the Rings or Frank Herbert's Dune say that much about how we as readers or receivers think about religion. The most fascinating thing is the vast majority of invented religions are based on science fiction or fantasy, and it's because science fiction and fantasy are the contemporary genres that most resemble mythology, which have other worlds that are imaginatively created, that people can engage with. And if you think about mythology and actually scriptures like the Bible, which a lot of Jewish and Christian people would be uncomfortable with referring to the Bible as mythology, but nevertheless it must contain mythological elements. It's fairly obvious. There is a kind of astonishing, dizzying evocation of other realities in books like, say, the Book of Revelation, the Apocalypse of John in the New Testament, or in the visions of the prophet Ezekiel in the Old Testament of the fiery chariot in the air with the cherubim and seraphim and all that kind of stuff. So I don't think it's any accident that people find those genres of sci-fi and fantasy the most fecund.
Professor Carol Cusack from the University of Sydney. Possibly the most well-known religion that emerged from fantasy or science fiction is Scientology, founded by the sci-fi author L. Ron Hubbard. Dr. Alad Thomas is a sociologist of religion, a teaching fellow at the University of Leeds. He studies people who practice Scientology independently of the official Church of Scientology in what is often called the free zone.
One of the particularly interesting aspects is that it's allowed them to share Scientology with one another, particularly more esoteric elements of Scientology that are typically held confidential until a Scientologist progresses enough through their spiritual development to encounter. Now through the internet, it's widely available. So it's affected the way Free Zone Scientologists practice in that sense. But also because they are practicing online and often individually, they're not bound by institutional rules. So while the Church of Scientology presents its vision of Scientology as per its founder, L. Ron Hubbard, in the free zone, you'll find lots of people doing various different things with Scientology, changing it, adapting it, that they've been enabled to do that by the fact that they practice on their own, particularly on the internet.
Okay. Aled, are there any distinguishing features between pre-internet new religious movements and post-internet new religious movements?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think what we find with post-internet new religious movements is the phenomenon of invented religions, particularly drawing from popular culture, where fandoms and pop culture narratives have managed to feed into new forms of religions from fans who are interacting with one another online. Another element as well is that new religious movements have a contested history. They can have highly charged discussions with people who would accuse them of being cults, for example. Access to the internet for both members of new religious movements and people who oppose those movements has essentially opened up an occasionally quite heated online discourse. So it's made them more publicly visible, but it's also given them the ability to respond in a public forum as well.
So discourse between who? Do you mean the followers of these new religious movements and people outside, or is it an internal discussion as well?
So there's an element of both. So you do have somebody who's in a new religious movement and somebody who opposes the movement. They could interact online. And this is the interesting part with Free Zone Scientology, is because there are so many people online doing Scientology outside of the church, changing Scientology, adapting it and so forth, they get into these heated discussions as well. So it's a bit of an error to think of Free Zone Scientology as a united movement, as a singular form of Scientology. That's why the term can be quite problematic, because actually many of these Free Zone Scientologists just don't get along with one another. They don't see eye to eye on the way that they do Scientology, and often on politics as well.
Allard and Carol Cusack are most interested in new religious movements rather than the fictional works they may have sprung from. But Allard's colleague, Dr. Vivian Isimos, studies what she calls contemporary mythology, which can include memes, video games, and even reality TV.
So I am an anthropologist of religion who specializes in looking at popular culture narratives and studying them as mythology. So I like to look at the way that we're telling stories and kind of delve into why those are important for people, why they're meaningful for people, and how they function as essentially contemporary mythology.
So when you're using the word myth, what do you mean by that word?
Good question. There's a lot of different ways to define myth or mythology, and a lot of people would probably all have very different definitions of it. But for me, the way that I see it working is that a myth or a mythology is a narrative or something akin to a narrative that an individual or a community uses to understand themselves and their position in this world. So that allows for the individuals or the communities, in order to tell me as a researcher what stories are important to them. So that way I'm not an outsider making decisions for them and saying, well, no, that's a myth, rather than this other thing that you really care about. And it means that I'm focusing on stories that allow people to see their worldview being reflected in the stories that they tell, or seeing the way their communities are constructed in the stories that they tell.
Can you give me an example of a modern myth?
There's a lot, but I can talk about the Legend of Zelda series, because it's one of the first times that I really solidified this idea because of my participants and the people that I was chatting to. So Legend of Zelda series is a video game series that's been going on since 1986. And I was chatting with somebody who had a tattoo of one of the symbols from the game on their arm, and we were just kind of chatting about it. And they mentioned that part of the story of that symbol is that the ideal person has a balance of wisdom, power, and courage. And so when we were chatting about the tattoo, this person tells me that they enjoy looking at the tattoo whenever they have to make a decision or they're confronted with an issue in their life. And they remember that the best way to deal with issues is with an equal balance of wisdom, power, and courage. So now this is somebody who sees the Legend of Zelda series as a way of guiding them through life, but they might not go quite as far as Carol Cusack's or Allard Thomas's hyper-real religions or invented religions. They're not going to put Hylian on a census record, for example.
Like as their religion.
But they still use it in a way that you might recognize as something hyper meaningful.
So like a spiritual framework or a philosophy of life, maybe.
Yeah. That's why I like to use myth. I think it's also complicated with definitions of religion, which I think might be a little bit much for right now. I define religion quite loosely, and that also helps to not only just see you know, what can fit within the umbrella term from an anthropological perspective, but also what I find fascinating about it is it really questions what religion can even be for people.
Now, you both do a podcast together. How do your two different fields complement each other, or, you know, maybe even contrast with each other?
Yeah, I think something I've really enjoyed seeing working with Vivian is that while, you know, we're both specialists in the study of religions, and Vivian has a more anthropological approach, I have a more sociological approach, mm-hmm. but we've really seen the way that those two fields can connect with one another, to the extent that we've slightly joked that, are they really that different? Which I know may upset some people, so I'm not saying that they I'm not saying that they are. But I think something that Vivian and I share in our mentality, as well as we like to explore some of the underexplored areas. We tend to avoid more traditional forms of religion or religious expressions. And we try to shine a light on some of the things that people don't talk about. And sometimes some of the things that people don't think is worth talking about. For example, some of my favorite discussions that we've had on our podcast have been about reality TV. What people take from reality TV, why they engage with it, why they enjoy it. Reality TV is very popular in a sense, much like how religion is. And we treat engagement with reality TV as forms of religious expression. Would you say so, Vivian?
Yeah, I was going to say that I used to always joke around that I was watching it because I was an anthropologist and it was part of research studies. But as I got a lot more into it, I started realizing there is a lot that you can learn from it, and you can learn a lot about the intersections of communities and the way that people interact with one another and the interesting ways that they construct dialogue. And these are all things that you try to pick up when you're doing anthropological research, and yet it's just right in front of me on reality TV.
Right, because you wouldn't consider reality TV to have a lot to do with religion. Is that the kind of parallel that you're looking for when you're studying a pop culture artifact like that?
So we actually did an episode on the Netflix reality show Love is Blind, which is this dating show thing where people get engaged without seeing each other. It's a really weird show. In the most recent season, there was a couple who broke up over a difference in religion. And right as they were breaking up, one of the characters, I say characters, they're people, but one of the people said, I can't believe in this day and age, you know, that a relationship can end over religion, you know, something like that. Wow. And I remember watching it and just going, oh, we could talk for like 3 hours on just this idea. So it's an interesting way of not only talking about how people engage with things, but it gives us an audible, exact example that we can pull from and say, here's how they view religion. And we can talk about it using this example that everyone can see and have their own opinions about.
Yeah, another episode of your podcast that I thought was quite interesting was about world building in fiction and religion. Go over for me what kind of in-fiction religions you've encountered in your own pop culture exploration.
I think in most elements of fiction, particularly fantasy fiction, will have their own religious engagements in some fashion. So obviously Legend of Zelda has their own like mythology. The Lord of the Rings has some really interesting in-depth religion and views on religion and mythology, especially when you start reading like the Silmarillion, for example. That particular episode of the podcast came out because I was listening to a podcast that is a live playing of a role-playing game, so something akin to D&D, but it's a different world set. It's a world that they all built, so it means that they also constructed religions within that world, and I was kind of having a go at some of their views on religion. So, you know, you can encounter these fictitious religions in big things, you know, these big titles like Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones. These are all, you know, titles that we all recognize that have their own constructed religions within them. But we also encounter them within our own world buildings and things like games of D&D that we play together or books that we're reading. I'm also a big fan of the Dresden Files books, for example, which takes mythologies and real world religions and kind of shifts them a little bit, which also presents really interesting commentary on these things if you wanted to study them from that kind of perspective.
Yeah, in the context of a role-playing game where perhaps the player is writing their own religion and that betrays something of their own beliefs about religion in the real world, does that also apply to the depiction of fictional faiths in pop culture works?
Oh, yeah. I think that one of the benefits of studying religion in popular culture is that there's a lot of different ways that you can approach it. So you can approach it from the perspective of pop culture as religion, which is a lot of what we've been talking about up till now. But then there's also other things that you can look at. You can look at the way that religions, for example, feel about, you know, physical world religions that we think of, like how does Christianity feel about movies or feel about pop culture? But you can also look at how pop cultures portray different religions and how each one of these things really betrays a lot about how the creators feel about religion more generally or about very specific religions. The Far Cry games, for example, have a very specific depiction of evangelical Christianity, which is obviously a negative commentary on evangelical Christianity. So you can really dig into that and say, well, what are these people saying? And therefore, what does that, you know, say about their views of this religion? And why might they think that about this religion? And that's a whole nother can of worms and digging into that is absolutely fascinating.
Dr. Vivian Acemos, anthropologist and independent academic, and before her, sociologist of religion, Dr. Alad Thomas. You're listening to Soul Search here on RN and the ABC Listen app, where we're looking at religion, popular culture, and how fictional faiths can become real. Vivian researches contemporary mythology, and she's the author of Digital Mythology and the Internet's Monster, The Slender Man. I asked her who, or what, is The Slender Man?
So the Slender Man is this monstrous figure of somebody who looks like a tall man wearing a suit, but is actually a bit different than that. And the most common difference that they'd say in the story is that he has no face. So there's all these fun depictions of a tall man wearing a suit with no face, kind of stalking people in the woods and things like that. The story came about on the Something Awful forum threads in about 2009, and it started from one person posting up just a photoshopped image with him in the background, and it kind of took off from there. And what's really fascinating about this story is that it's lasted and that it's really impacted the horror storytelling communities online. And one of the things that's really interesting about the story when you dig into it is that the meanings of it and the way that people have attached things to it has actually changed over time, which is something that you would typically see from myths. So the way that we would tell a myth at the beginning of its life would be very different than later on, which is why this idea of myth as being something set and written is actually quite not accurate. It's things that would shift over time for reasons. The reason being that the world changes and the way that you see the world changes over time. And sometimes storytellers will take their own agency into it and say, well, I want to see the world change in this way, so I'm going to tell the story differently to purposefully make that change. And this is what was happening with the Slender Man. And so you had people taking it and running with it in all sorts of different ways. And one of the more fascinating aspects of monsters in general is that it teaches us what is scary to people, where the anxiety lies for certain communities, and where it's settled in its most recent iteration for the Slender Man has been a distrust of news sources and distrust of wider society of the quote unquote man, you know, and which is fair in a way, but it also really shows just where people's distrust and anxiety lie, which is fascinating.
How is that idea expressed through the Slender Man mythos?
So people will take newspaper articles, for example, and make it look as if the newspaper article is about the Slender Man. And it'll look like someone physically scanned in the newspaper, or they'll Photoshop images, or they will. One of my favorite ones, this was from like the really early 2009 days, was somebody took German woodcuts, like really old school German woodcuts, and they edited them slightly to have figures with multiple arms and no face and things like that. And now when you search those German woodcuts, the Slenderman ones pop up as like one of the first ones.
Oh, wow.
So they've actually kind of changed the narrative of German woodcuts from a specific time frame because of their slight editing of them. So yeah, they kind of shift the real world. And I'm using real in quotes, the real world to tell this fictional story, but meaning that we can't really trust these things. But they're doing it all with a, I should really stress, they're doing it with a wink and a nod. You're supposed to know that this is what's going on.
And Ella, do you encounter this in your work at all?
Yes, it's very interesting because I think with the groups that I study, in contrast to Vivian's, as you know, as Vivian was saying, somebody wouldn't put Hylian from Zelda on a census, for example, but somebody would, say, put Scientologist, for example. It causes rifts when somebody introduces new ideas, particularly new stories, to an already established one. While what Vivian was saying about how some of the groups she studied, they do it with a wink and a nod. People know that they're in on something. With the groups I've studied, it's quite different. It's quite, I'd only use the word real because that would really upset Vivian. and I wouldn't say real either. But people treat the stories behind the ways that their movements have been established very seriously, in a way that if you deviate or if you present a new narrative, you are going to get quite a bit of backlash.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is the interesting thing about new religious movements, is that a lot of the time we all know where they've come from and who made them. How does that affect the way that we think about them?
Well, that is a really interesting thing because, you know, you can't speak to somebody who knew Jesus of Nazareth, for example. But you can speak to somebody who knew L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology. And we live in an age where, you know, documentation is far more vast. People get to see more of a figure today than you would a figure that you're trying to decipher from historical documents 2,000 years ago. You know, what happened, what didn't happen. With new religious movements, we know people who knew these founders, and sometimes they have extremely flattering things to say and sometimes they don't. And that can create a bit of a disconnect for some people, really. That I often say that the big difference between a new religion and a mainstream religion is simply time. That a mainstream religion seems to have greater public acceptance because it's always been there. We've always known these religions to be there from the day that we were born, whereas new religious movements have been founded by people we know. And that seems to create a bit of a disconnect for some people.
Yeah, I was going to say that what I find interesting about what the connections between what Ala does and what I do is the fact that I see a lot of the engagements of new religious movements as quite similar to fan fiction. You know, people will take narratives regardless of what the author initially intended, even if we can directly hear from that. You know, this is something that we see a lot with Harry Potter, for example. J.K. Rowling has loved to just talk online about all sorts of things, of what, you know, she intended or didn't intend, or what she feels and doesn't feel. And it has impacted the community tremendously. And yet one of the biggest impacts of it is people saying, we reject your narrative as author and we have our own. Mm. And yet they're the author, but they're able to say, no, you're not anymore. We're able to shift this in the way that we want to interpret it. And that's just how it's going to be.
Yeah, control is a really interesting issue when it comes to new invented religions, online discourses and so forth. Who controls the ideas that they're dealing with? Who controls the narratives that they deal with? And it's that free nature of the internet that it's so easily accessible that it just allows people to run with ideas.
Sociologist Alad Thomas and anthropologist Vivian Asimos. Together, they host the Religion and Popular Culture podcast, and there's a link on the Soul Search website. So, where are we? If the line between fan culture and faith is so blurry, it raises the huge question of, well, what is a religion? A question Professor Carol Cusack has circled around for most of her academic life.
I think it's interesting. One of the reasons I wrote the book Invented Religions is because I wanted to point out that basically they looked and functioned like real religions. Mm-hmm. And if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, chances are it's a duck. You should be able to understand, looking at the processes of developing this kind of religion, that the end product is largely indistinguishable, except, of course, its origins aren't shrouded in divine revelation or distant antiquity. And I think a lot of people who work in this sort of field now, not just with the invented subcategory, but with new religious movements particularly, which is a much bigger area, which I would technically say I am a new religious movement scholar. Mm. It's just that the invented stuff is a particular slice of that pie I'm interested in. People who study new religious movements use them often as test cases for existing definitions, whether definitions that are legally mandated by constitutions or judiciaries, to common sense person in the street. What do you think a religion is? Oh, it has to involve God and a building like a church, and people have to think that something's going to happen after death. You know, that sort of stuff. And we use, as scholars, these sorts of hard cases to test how workable a lot of those definitions are.
Mm.
And often they're found wanting.
Well, and it's quite an important question, really, because it's got legal implications and tax implications. You know, once money gets involved, it's pretty important.
It is interesting. In America, of course, which is a highly pro-religious society, it's actually very, very easy to both register a religion and to get tax exemptions as a religion. In Australia, it's extremely difficult. There is no formal registration of a religious practice, and the groups that get tax breaks, I would say probably actually are all members of highly traditional understandings of groups. And even the groups that have come lately into Australian society, like Sikhs and Muslims and Hindus, nevertheless have venerable traditions to point to.
Well, Carol, I could talk to you about this all day, I think, but we have run out of time. But thank you so much for being on the program.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Carol Cusack, Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Sydney and author of Invented Religions, Imagination, Fiction and Faith. You also heard Dr. Vivian Asimos. She's an academic specialising in religion and contemporary mythology. She's also the author of Digital Mythology and the Internet's Monster, The Slender Man. And Dr. Alad Thomas, teaching fellow at the University of Leeds and associate lecturer at the Open University. He's the author of Free Zone Scientology, Contesting the Boundaries of a New Religion. Together, they're the co-hosts of the Religion and Popular Culture podcast. I'm Rowan Salmond. Thanks for joining me here on Soul Search. If you liked this episode about invented religions, you might also enjoy my investigation into the Satanic Panic, Dungeons & Dragons, and Harry Potter. There's a link on the Soul Search website. Thanks to Najet El-Ghouli and Meredith Lake for production assistance, and to Beth Stewart for sound engineering. Join us next time for Soul Search here on RN and the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.